When you need expert help and advice on issues affecting your business, NFU Cymru, we're here for you.
Want to get to know the people who produce the food that you eat? This is the place. Step this way and welcome to Rock and Roll Farming. Hey everybody, and welcome to Rock and Roll Farming episode 40. I'm your host, Will Evans, and tonight I am heading down to the very heart of England, to Shakespeare's County, Warwickshire, to talk to farmer and current chairman of the Agricultural and Horticultural Development Board, Beef and Lamb, Adam Quinney. Adam, how are you?
Hi, very well, thank you. Good to talk to you, Will.
You too. It's been we've had a lot of chat on Twitter over the last few years, so I'm really excited to actually speak to you in person. It's great.
We've got to think of a term for this, haven't we? We talk about, I've been chatting. No, you haven't. You've been tapping away on your phone.
It's everyone's still getting used to the sort of social media, how to do it, aren't they? Because I bump into people sometimes, but I did bump into quite a few people this last week I know from Twitter, and you know, it's that thing where you know them on your phone, and you think you know them, but you don't really, and it's a bit awkward, isn't it?
There you go. I think the thing is with social media is to bear in mind that maybe a friend on Facebook, but they're not really a friend, so it's an acquaintance, and not take it too seriously and develop a bit of a thick skin. Otherwise, I think you can take things very much the wrong way sometimes if someone's tapping on a keyboard somewhere.
Absolutely. So you've been enjoying this cold and frosty weather we've been having?
Yeah, it has. I mean, I have to say the ewes look well. They didn't enjoy the wet weather in December, lost a little bit of condition then, but this dry weather, it's been much better. Now it's nice old turf at the moment, so looking quite well. So, and you know, I want to stay nice and dry and cool because I'll be weaning the calves next week, so I don't want any damp, warm weather. Thank you very much for that.
Absolutely. So you farm with your wife, Sarah, in Warwickshire, just south of Redditch. Can you tell us a bit about the farm and the area that you live?
Yeah, it's sort of quite heavy sort of clay soils, with a bit of topsoil on top, and it makes good grassland, quite challenging arable. Mm-hmm. The family have been here for quite a while, and then in the 80s there was a bit of a change, and I was a typical young farmer in my 20s, argued with my father a lot. You know, we'd be arguing how to move the cattle down the road. In the meantime, the cattle had actually gone down the road and found their way into the right field without our assistance at all. And he said, well, it's when set aside was coming in. He said, well, look, let's put the farm into set aside, have a machinery sale, sell all the machinery. We had an offer for the old farm buildings. We sold those as a family. And I've been I started a small sheep flock then and rented it off him and his brothers and gradually built it up with a few other people. So now we have a suckler herd of about 100 Solaire cows, and we have a couple of hundred, ewes, mostly the sort of the clin based ewe, but we've been changing over to Easy Care to gradually make them to shedders.
What kind of ewe was that?
The clin ewe.
The clin
ewe. Yes, sorry. I'm an Englishman, sorry.
I haven't interviewed one person who's pronounced it correctly yet.
Call them lins, that's a start. but we started off with those. We had back in the early 90s, we had a real outbreak of toxoplasmosis and enzootic abortion in 1 year. And I said, never again are we going to that's going to happen to us. Yeah. So we became a closed flock, apart from buying the odd up, and we've been a closed flock ever since. After foot and mouth, the ewe numbers dropped, and simply because we had a scheduled D notice on our farm for 4 months, which completely wrecked our livestock business, to be honest. And then we've gone to later lambing. So we lamb in April outside. It suits our system well. It means when the cattle come in, there's plenty of grass for the ewes to run around through the winter. So it means our costs are very minimal on the ewes, and we finish all the lambs off red clover that's used to make silage for the cattle. So it's the ewes actually work very well for us.
Yeah, okay. And why Solaires? Why Solaire breed?
About 15 years ago, we were traditionally, like a lot of farmers, using a Hereford cross Holstein, mm-hmm. to excellent cow, served us very well. We were getting into at the time into the Hereford scheme for Waitrose, and we had a real issue on the heifers. If we grew them, you know, more than half a kilo a day, they came too fat. Mm-hmm. So that was a bit of an issue for us. We were wondering what to do. And I went on a trip to with the NFU, local NFU, to North Italy, where we saw some fantastic cattle, brilliantly run, being finished in Italy. And a lot of those were Solaire Cross Charolais, and they were performing extremely well. And that got me interested into the Charolais Cross Solaire and in Solaire. So then I went to France and saw the Solaires out there, went to their bull testing centres and stuff. That got me interested in genetics. And so I went, what I wanted, you know, you can't sell an animal unless it's been born alive and done well. And so we went down a Solaire route for easy calving. Mm. And the idea was she's a bit leaner than a New Hereford. And so we could go back to the Angus scheme or Hereford scheme or Charolais. And we wouldn't we'd have, you know, they'd all be of a marketable weight without these heifers from the three-quarter Herefords. Where heifers were a bit of an issue for us. So that's why, really. And they've been. They've lived up to their reputation. I'm touching lots of wood as I say this. But the last 2 years, I've only calved one cow.
Yeah, okay, that's pretty impressive.
So I can't really complain. And this year we calved over 40 heifers.
Did you?
At 24 months and didn't touch a single calf.
Yeah.
So I'm pleased to say I do not know how to carve a cow.
Well, that's
touching lots of wood because, you know, I can see it all going belly up come our summer carving this year.
Yeah, okay. Well, that's extremely impressive. So you've also got some arable acreage on the farm.
Yeah. So. Yeah, we got a bit of arable. To be honest with you, we're not very good arable farmers. And my neighbour is an excellent arable farmer. And so about 3 years ago, I went and saw him and said, look, you've got those grass banks you're not quite sure what to do with. Why don't we do an acre for acre swap? And so I still have an interest in the arable, but he mainly runs it, looks after it, combines it, puts it in his store. And I look after his grassland with our stock under a grazing agreement. And so it works well for both of us, actually. Yeah. And so the arable still rotates around our farm. So we can, if we've got a bad field of thistles, it can go into arable for a couple of years and tidy it up and go back in. And same with him on the fields he had bad black grass in. We've gone and grassed down and put a clover lay in for a few years and keep it tight to get on top of the black grass. So it's a excellent working relationship, really. Mm. And I think, you know, something we want to look at to do more of, to be honest.
Yeah, absolutely. I think collaboration between farmers is going to be increasingly important over the coming years, isn't it?
Yeah, and keep it simple. Mm. You still got to. I think it's important that I'm a strong believer in diverse farms, but I think we as individuals may become more specialised.
Mm. Well, mixed farming systems are quite fashionable again, aren't they? I mean, is that something that you purposely choose to do with collaborating with your neighbour, using livestock
yes.
with the arable rotation?
It is, but for me personally, it means my investment is specialised.
Yeah.
All my equipment is livestock-based. All my skills and focus is on livestock, and his focus can be purely on arable. Mm. And I think that's important. And I need a simple, straightforward system because I'm away from the farm so much. Yeah. It's only Sarah and my wife on the farm that we need to have a nice, simple system that we can run that doesn't need. You know, I don't want to make a part-time job full-time, so we have to run it efficiently.
Yeah. Okay. And I know you've got three grown-up children there.
Yeah, they're all in their 20s. I'm a grandfather. God, I can't believe it. I'm a grandfather of two great granddaughters, aged 3 and 4, who come on the farm and go back home smelling of silage. Mm. So, yeah, it's good fun.
Yeah, okay. But none of them are wanting to take over the farm.
No, not at all. My son is a mad cyclist. Anybody who follows me on Twitter would have seen about a year ago.
Yes.
He was cycling across New Zealand. Didn't quite make it. Had a heat stroke, 300 kilometres from the end. But he was aiming to do New Zealand in under 96 hours. I mean, when he was 18, he did Land's End to John O'Groats in 4 days. You know, so he's unlike his father, he's rather skinny.
But is that
they've gone and done what they want to do, and I think that's important.
Yeah.
And that also puts, it's going to be interesting how farm structures change, because I think a lot of farmers are like me. Their children have not gone farming. Uh-huh. They've gone and done other things, what they want to do. Yeah. And we've got to think about a new type of farming partnerships with junior associates and that sort of thing to keep that farm going efficiently and still keep the energy levels up in the farm to develop it and push it on the whole time. Otherwise, you know, you see it go backwards if you don't have that energy and drive.
I think you're dead right. There is a lot of farmers' children who don't necessarily want the farm, but they're equally, there's an awful lot of very keen
able
young
people
trying to get in, isn't there? So
yeah, and some really, you know, through the Henry Blum Foundation, which I'm a trustee on, yeah, we see some amazing people come through our door, and I wish we could help them all. But some really fascinating people who want to make a difference. And I think farming, personally, I mean, I'm one of those lucky people that I'm still very excited by farming.
Yeah.
You know, I may say I'm a grumpy farmer at times, but I still absolutely love it. But I also think if you don't enjoy it, it's probably the worst occupation in the world.
Yeah.
But if you love it, I don't want to do anything else. I thoroughly enjoy it.
I think that's a very good way of putting it. So in your interview notes that you sent to me, you said, and I quote, that you became involved in campaigning for farming because you were pissed off.
Yep. So. Yeah. I think a lot of people do. I think something really gets their goat. And they say, what on earth is going on here? Why isn't someone doing something about this?
Yeah.
And I'm sure lots of other people in the National Beef Association, NSA. Yeah. So I became involved in NFU almost by accident, really. My neighbour took me to the local NFU meetings, and people who know me know that I do tend to talk quite a lot. So I opened my mouth a few times, and before I knew it, they voted me onto the committee, and I thought, bugger it, I better join now. So
that does tend to happen in NFU, doesn't it? If you you speak up, you're on the committee.
you are indeed. And it's been a great experience. I've learned a lot. I've met some amazing people. And there's no doubt about it for me, you know, that we've made a huge difference as an organisation. The breadth of people working within the NFU, you know, you go to down Defra into Whitehall, you know, the NFU is well known. The specialist team in the London office, you know, they're out there every day at every opportunity explaining what's happening to farming to MPs, and of course in our Brussels office over in explaining to MEPs the situation as well. I'm picking up on things before they happen, but it all works so well when you get local involvement, meeting MPs back on their home turf, so they hear the same message from people locally as they hear in the halls of Westminster, and then that's a very powerful message.
Absolutely. Well, I know. When you first got involved, and you first got on your local committee, tell us about setting up a demo then on your local village group.
Yeah, it was at the height of BSC, and I believe, you know, this is not just about farmers. The BSC crisis was about the whole industry, and you know, from abattoirs and so on, but also, you know, as farmers, we buy things, we trade with other businesses. So I put together on our local village green quite rapidly, really. Basically, everybody as a business we'd written a cheque to. So it was everybody there, from our sheep shearer to the sheep scanner to our vet to the local feed supplier, merchant, so on, the bank, insurance companies. And there's about 65 businesses on the village green. My message really was, look, agriculture, supporting agriculture, you support a lot of rural communities as well. And we're all dependent upon this farming family having a success. So you help me, in turn, you help all these other businesses as well. And really, that was the message. And it was also a good message for those businesses who thought, actually, we do supply a lot of farmers. Gosh, actually, they are quite important to us, you know, like the accountant there. So he said, well, actually, 40% of my clients are farmers. I need them to be successful so they can pay me their bills. So it was a good all-round day, really. And that's what really got me on started. And from that, I went on to the National Livestock Committee.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, that's actually a fantastic idea, just visually, isn't it? I mean, you could list all the sort of ancillary industries of agriculture, but actually seeing them there in one place is a great idea.
And you know, even like Severn Trent, I got the people we buy the water from, and they said, well, why have we got to be here? And I said, well, there's so many cattle in the region, they drink so much per day, you charge so much per cube, therefore this industry is worth so many millions a year to you. And they said, right, we'll be there.
Yeah,
So I think it's important to remind people how important to rural communities agriculture actually is.
Absolutely. Okay, so then you became involved in the Meat and Livestock Commission Promotion Council various other livestock related bodies.
Yeah.
Did you obviously enjoy getting involved with these committees and boards? It's obviously something you feel comfortable with.
I suppose like most people, the thought of sitting down in committees and just yakking is not really what it's about.
Yeah.
You know, you want to go there and make a difference. Uh-huh. And so some things like the moments on, because I was on the NFU Livestock Committee, I was appointed to go on to the MLC Beef and Lamb Promotion Council. Mm-hmm. And I find that absolutely fascinating to talk to professionals about it, but also to do something a bit more tangible for agriculture and for farmers in general. And exactly the same way my involvement in the Studley College Trust, helping young people get grants to go and get an agricultural education, is something really tangible to go and do. And that's really satisfying.
Hugely rewarding, I must think. Yeah. So you were the NFU Council Delegate for Warwickshire for 6 years.
That's right, yes, and probably made myself unpopular by saying I think nobody should do more than 6 years, and there's quite a few there, done a few more years than that. But I do believe in turnover of people in those positions. Hmm. Simply that it's quite difficult to get people to do them.
Yeah.
And if they feel, oh goodness, I'm going to be doing this for decades, it's not exactly. But if you say, no, just do it for 4 years, that would be great, or something, they go, yeah, I could probably do that. So I that's one of the reasons why I came off after 6 years. And it was at that time I set up a beef unit with ASDA and ABP. So I was pretty busy on the farm anyway.
Yeah.
So I had a year off, really, from lobbying, which is quite fun.
Yeah. I suppose with things like that, it's not only that it's sort of easier to attract people if it's only a shorter period of time. It also brings in, it regularly then brings some fresh ideas and new enthusiasm as well, doesn't it?
You need a constant steady flow of new people coming in. So you've got experienced people there, been around a few years, but also some new ideas and energy coming in as well. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, it's the same group of people talking to each other.
Yeah. Okay, so then after your year setting up the beef unit, you obviously got twitchy feet again, and
it was pure accident, to be honest. I came involved in the NFU again. Farming Today came out in January, I think, and did an interview on the farm, and they used my sort of interview to link up other interviews on the sort of Saturday morning program, and then a friend of mine rang me up on a Sunday and said, "I've just nominated you for to be NFU elections."
Oh wow! Okay.
Yes, so I said, "Thanks, Clive." Because the nominations were the following Wednesday, so I sat down with my wife and said, "I'd be closed by then." I said, "Okay." So I said, "Wife, shall I go for this?" And she said, "Yeah, go on then." So I stood for an office holder and was elected, and that was an amazing 2 years at the start of the Badger Culls and everything else. So it was a real privilege to do.
Absolutely. I mean that's. Yeah, you made that all sound quite easy, but that's some achievement to get voted onto there. And I mean, it must have been quite a big decision to go for it after being nominated out of the blue like that.
It was. To be honest, I didn't think I was going to get it. I wasn't in office. I wasn't on council or anything at the time. But I think what I'm pleased about is what I'm saying is you don't have to be a council member to stand for an office holder and be elected. Mm. I came off after 2 years, which I didn't want to, but that's politics for you, and that's democracy. If you believe in democracy, you've got to be prepared to win and lose. And I'm still very much an NFU supporter, so it was a fantastic role to do, and it was at the peak of getting the Badger Culls underway over those 2 years, and I was really honoured to be involved in that as well, and met some farmers who did a huge amount of work to get those cows working in Somerset and Gloucester. And I tell you what, the industry deserves them a debt of gratitude because nobody knew at the time when we started about what the actual reaction would be. You know, it was totally the unknown. And so those people were very cautious and very brave to make a start on it.
Absolutely. I mean, I know you've had some experience with TB in your own cattle as well. I mean, where do you think we are with it at the moment? I mean, we're told the situation's improving, but I can tell you that it doesn't really feel like it in this part of the world.
Well, I think it's we need a whole range of measures to combat bovine TB, badger control, especially in areas of high incidence, especially with breeding herds, I think is vital. But also, it's also vital that we improve our biosecurity and trading of cattle. It's also vital that we have a better test. Yeah. And I think the work that's been done recently in Devon, partly funded, I understand, by Brian May with using PCR tests, looks interesting because we know from we believe from the work that's done that badgers can be responsible up to 50% of the eventual numbers of cattle with TB by introducing it and then cattle spreading it to cattle within the herd. But even if we removed all the badgers, there'd still be a big chunk of TB spreading within the cattle. So I think it's important that we approach it as broadly as possible to combat this disease. Yeah. Because I think one of the biggest costs of TB, and we've had TB on this farm, I know what it does to your calving patterns and fertility and everything else, testing while you're bulling and so on. Yeah, it's a huge impact in time and effort. But I felt after having TB on the farm, the biggest impact was your whole focus is on dealing with TB and not dealing with BVD, yonis, genetic programs in your cattle because you think you're going to lose. We lost a third of our cows. So it can really knock you back. And I think that stops us as an industry dealing with some other things we need to deal with that actually probably in the long run will cost us as much as TB.
Yes, I mean, and also not to mention just the emotional toll it's taking on a lot of people as well.
It's huge. And, especially if you've got cattle outside, the stress levels of handling beef cattle, especially as you know, Will, that second day that they come into the temporary pens the first day, okay? The second day's test, it can be a different kettle of fish altogether.
Yeah.
So it's the physical stress, the emotional stress, and you always tend to lose your best cattle with the best genetics. And if they're heavily in calf as well, you wonder what on earth you're doing.
Yeah.
And some people have been shut down for 10 years, and I don't know how they cope with it, to be honest.
No, I know a few in that kind of situation. So, I mean, I was at the Oxford Farming Conference last week, and Michael Gove's keynote speech, I thought he broadly hit the right notes, really, but I did think that he perhaps could have mentioned TB, actually, in just his continued support for the cull. But yeah, there you go.
I think we should always be looking for perhaps more and thinking about more targeted methods on the badger cull and perhaps take lessons in France where they actually make the set where they go and remove the badgers from, make it impossible for badgers to go and repopulate that set. So I think, around cases where we've had, especially around breeding farms, I think we should look at perhaps, say, fencing around some of those sets and then removing the badgers so we don't get perturbation either into the new badgers coming in or when we get all the badgers in that area where we know we've got a high rate of infection. I think we should always be developing. We shouldn't just stick with the one model. We should think about new models that might be more targeted and more effective in the future as well.
Absolutely. Okay, so AHDB then. Agricultural and Horticultural Development Board.
It trips off the tongue, doesn't it?
It does. I'm struggling a bit with it. But so for anyone listening who's not in the UK, farmers listening might be in the States or New Zealand, something like that. First, could you explain briefly what it is?
Okay. For those in the States and in New Zealand, it's like Beef and Lamb New Zealand, or it's like the Checkoff program. We collect a levy at slaughter on beef and lamb, for the beef and lamb sector. The other sectors within HDB, dairy, cereals, and potatoes, and horticulture, and so on, they collect different types of levy, either based on area or from sales. But in beef and lamb, we collect it at the point of slaughter, and we invest that about 50% of it in either market development or promotion. We spend the rest either on things such as knowledge exchange or R&D and that sort of thing. So the bulk is spent on promotion and developing markets, and the rest is spent on, as I say, knowledge exchange, managing data, producing booklets and R&D and liaising and setting up things such as antimicrobial resistance work and so on. So that's in a thumbnail sketch, that's what we do.
I see. And how did you initially get involved, and what's your role there?
Well, I chair the beef and lamb sector. So I sit on the main AHDB board where the other sectors come together, and that's chaired by Peter Kendall. So we have overall governance by bringing all those sectors together, and that's been something that's been accelerated under Peter's chairmanship because the sectors were operating independently. So we couldn't do things easy. Well, we did a bit, but it was difficult. But now it's much easier to do things that affect all the sectors, such as soils, or antimicrobial resistance, which is obviously highly important for the pig industry and the dairy industry and the beef and sheep industry. It means we can share that expertise and knowledge and work programs across the sectors. If you're a good geneticist, whether you're working in the dairy industry or in the beef and sheep sector, you can do either. So it's important that we pool that knowledge. So it means we can share vets across the sectors and so on. It's cuts our overheads. More importantly, it gives us more buying power when we're talking to providers of promotional work or what have you. So we've cut down the number of agents we've got. It's made us more efficient. It's made us stronger in the marketplace when we go and buy services. It's meant we've been a size where we can bring skills and expertise, especially around digital work, in-house, which again is cheaper and more flexible and quicker. So it's been a bit of a journey to do that, but it's made us a much fitter, stronger organisation.
Absolutely. I mean, is that pretty much a full time role that you're doing now, then?
You can make it one. I do about 3 days a week for AHDB, and obviously quite a few phone calls in between, and reading papers in the evening and that sort of thing. But I think it's really important that whoever chairs it is a working farmer, because it's nothing like being out there in the reality dealing with it. I think to bring that bit of extra energy into chairing those sectors.
Okay, and consumer wise, who are you focused on consumer wise?
Well, about a year ago we looked at our strategies very carefully, and we were doing lots of things, and we made a decision to do less on certain areas and to give us more focus where we could either have a make a difference that would have an impact on the industry. So on the advertising side, we said, actually, who is key for this? It's very easy to sell more lamb to somebody who's already eating lamb. But it is really important that actually for who isn't eating lamb and why aren't they eating it. And that tends to be the everybody now terms the millennials, but basically it's people between 20 and 35 are not eating lamb. And so it's important for us in our work that we speak to them, that we help them, inform them, break myths and so on. So part of most of our focus on lamb is towards the next generation of lamb eaters. And it's important to understand how they gain information. And, you know, you watch anybody of that generation, they don't sit down and watch Coronation Street and watch the adverts. They'll watch things on catch up. They'll watch things on their handheld. They'll have ad blockers on, so they miss all the ads. So but what they are interested in, then they're open to influence through influencers, you know, whether it's chefs, whether it's people who talk to them. There's quite a few people on, say, YouTube that have 500,000 followers, and they make their own programs, and the people who watch them are in our target audience. And that's quite cost effective to get those influencers to do recipes. So I won't see those because I don't follow them, but our target audience does. On beef, it's actually a bit different. We have a lot of beef eaten by millennials. That's not really an issue for them because they know what to do with it more. But one of the things we do have beef, it is a high value product. You know, we have one of the highest retail prices in the world on beef in the UK is actually eating quality. So a lot of our focus is on eating quality, and that's not just what we do on farm. It's also to do with butchery techniques. It's about making sure there's no connective tissue in there. It's about looking at standards. It's about looking at new classification techniques. So the classification of the cattle reflects the retail value rather than simply the meat yield of the carcass. So all that work's going on to make sure that when our consumer goes into the retailer, one, they understand what they're purchasing. We inform them and help them through that process. So we're building up a better relationship with the retailers. So when they make that purchase, they buy the product they want to buy. They know what they want to do with it. They have a good eating experience, and then they come back again. What we don't want to happen is some displays in major retailers, someone's put all the cuts in a wheelbarrow and tipped them on the shelf. People are confused about what they're buying, so they turn around and pick up a chicken. Or if they do buy it, they might buy the wrong cut that's not suitable for what they want to do, or there may be connective tissue in there. And if somebody eats a bit of gristle, our research shows that people are out of that category for up to 12 weeks. That's 12 weeks lost of sales. So getting the eating quality right is crucial, because that's the way we're going to defend ourselves against some good quality imports from around the world, by having strong brand loyalty, because we've delivered for those consumers on the plate. And we do a pretty good job already, but it's about going the next stage further.
Absolutely. I mean, just going back to what you said about trying to get into new young people, they're obviously not watching TV adverts and reading newspapers and things like that. Has social media helped in that aspect? Are you trying to sort of use that more?
Yeah, so we do use social media, but the way we use social media, as I say, is we go to the influencers, people who already have a strong social media presence, and we use them to do the programs on beef and lamb and so on. That's quite important. And we're also upping our work into the halal market. We're upping our work into food service people, because let's face it, people, when they go out and eat, try things that they wouldn't try at home. They go, well, that was quite good. Could we do this at home? Yeah, I think we probably could. So again, it's quite a good intro into lamb especially. And, you know, 50% of a lamb is eaten out of the home. So it's important, you know, it's very easy to focus on the retailers, but it's important also we focus on the food service industry as well.
Interesting. Okay, so according to AHDB's latest Horizon report, which was launched last week at the Oxford Farm Conference, British farmers are falling behind their major competitors in terms of productivity, with pace setters like the US and the Netherlands growing productivity three times faster than the UK. I was quite surprised at that. Do you go along?
Okay, let's make sure we're understanding what we're talking about productivity. This is about not about yield. It's about the return you get on your investment and your time and your money wise in crop. And you look at, you know, you do see in the States there's been a huge technological advance. You go to their agricultural colleges and universities based in the States. There's a big KE program. Any R&D program, research and development program, has to have a KE package within it to get it out to farmers. So there's been a big extension program for a long period of time. And, you know, if you're in a bar in America having chat about cattle, you know, it actually gets a pretty quickly quite a technical discussion. Very much so. I mean, once you get onto your head that Charolais, Simmentals, are all black, because they're purely interested in the genetics of an animal rather than necessarily the name they've put to it. And if you go to the Netherlands, I think you've known about it, there's been a huge they've used the common agriculture policy to help their investment in farms, in technology, training, and they have high value products in the Netherlands as well, especially in their horticulture industry, which probably distorts the figures a bit. But a challenge to people like myself as a farmer, and you, Will, is most of us walk around our farms and go, oh, yeah, we could do that bit better. Yes, we could do that bit better. But it's about having a confidence in the future to make that investment. A lot of us have held back in uncertainty, what's happening with Brexit, what will happen to lamb exports and so on, that has held us perhaps making that long-term investment that you need. And it comes back also to part of the conversation when we're talking about succession. You know, I walk around my yard and go, yeah, that's worth it. But suppose I'm not farming here in 5 years' time, do I want to make that sort of investment? Well, so about having a strong succession plan also helps people make that investment, which ups productivity.
Okay. So, what can we do? This is a very broad question, but what can we do as farmers to amend this, to improve our productivity? I know that that the AHDB, as part of this, have laid out a sort of 5-point plan. This talked about a nationally coordinated strategy for research and innovation, a new What Works Centre for Agriculture and Horticulture, coordinated knowledge exchange to advance best practice, a new national skills framework for farmers, and a boost for farmer-to-farmer learning. I mean, it's obviously, there's obviously a strategy in place, but how do we, as normal farmers on the ground, how do we get it all?
Well, I think the first stage is to make use of what we've already got, because those things you've laid out in that plan is to a certain degree is about proposals to governments about how they can help and assist us in doing that. So we already have our strategy network of farms. You have your Farming Connect in Wales. And I think certainly I've learned a huge amount by working with other farmers, whether it's in the Cotswold Sheep Group or whatever, going around other farms. And, you know, we all make mistakes and we learn from our mistakes and we improve on it. And I think going and talking to other farmers with a bit of guidance from organisations as AHDB is to give it a bit of focus and draw it together is important. I also think as farmers, we have a huge amount of data within our systems. You know, the cattle we've bought, sold, what we fed them, how they grew, where they went, how they classified. We look at our cows. But it's actually very difficult to extract that information and make a which are my best 25% of my cows and my worst 25% of my cows. So I think there's also work to do, which we are doing with the farm software companies to help people collate that data so they can benchmark. You can look on our website under benchmarking, and that is developing the whole time. So you can go on there, put your own data in through the year. You don't have to do it in one session. See, actually, where am I doing well? Where am I doing badly? Where have I got to put emphasis into my business? None of this is particularly exciting, sexy stuff. but in actual fact, it's bread and butter for most industries that have moved on. So I think, you know, analysis of what you're doing on your farm, analysis of what you're doing right and what you're doing wrong, and going to other people who've got that bit right and learning from them. It might be a fundamental change of your genetics. I think for most people would agree, there's no one single silver bullet that's going to solve all your problems on the farm. Yeah. It's actually about incremental gains around the farm, either to increase your margin or produce output to improve that gap that we need to get. Now, of course, the sort of the doubt of this policy say, well, that's all very well you're saying, Adam, that means you want to produce it cheaper. Well, yeah, doesn't mean I want to sell it cheaper. That's why export markets are so important for our part of our strategy, to develop as much competition as possible for your stock. But why wouldn't you want to produce it more efficiently and gain a bigger margin? It's about margin is so important for all of us on our farms to invest for the future.
Okay. So now I've been at a couple of AHDB meetings lately and their Welsh equivalent HCC, and it's fair to say that they usually tend to inspire spirited debate at these meetings. Is it an impossible task to please all your members? I mean, I guess you have to have a pretty thick skin.
It is. But I actually think, you know, people, I do have quite a thick skin. But I'm also up for debate.
Yeah.
And I know when we've got some levy payer meetings end of this month around the regions, so have a look on our website for your local one. It's the last week in January. And people say, well, Adam, you know, you haven't agreed to anything. I said, well, hold on a moment. We've had a good debate. I'll tell you what, when we're in the car afterwards and we're going home, when the meeting's the following week, what we've discussed at this meeting comes up again and again and again through the year. So I think it's important that having that robust conversation is actually good, because through that robust conversation, you actually look at yourself as much as the conversation you're having with the other person. And you might go home and go, was I right? Perhaps we could try that. And of course, we're trying to find a balance between lifestyle, you know, some people, you know, I can quite understand it. You know, some of the grassland management things, like I said, makes a farm into a 7-day job rather than moving cattle every day. If you're going to be mob grazing, that might not suit some people with other commitments they've got to have elsewhere. But there's a bit of something you learn from every single farmer you meet. You go, God, that's a good idea. I'm going to nick that idea. It's going to make my life easier.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I mean, and at the end of the day, everybody involved cares about the industry, don't they? Everybody's passionate about what they do, and everybody wants the best for it. But it's just finding the way forward that works best for us all, isn't it?
And sometimes it's not new ideas, Will. Sometimes the old ideas were the better, and it's always a mistake to feel like, just think our grandparents were idiots. They weren't.
Oh no, not at all.
You look at some of the things they did was truly awesome. So I think it's not just about all new ideas. It's sometimes remembering some of these older ideas as well.
Absolutely. And you said that the levy payer event's coming up at the end of January.
Yeah. So we got events down in the southwest, West Midlands, East Midlands, South East, and the North West. So come along. Our key staff are going to be there talking about our marketing campaigns this coming year in beef and lamb, how we're going to use the European money we've managed to draw down. That's part of a €10 million campaign with the French and the Irish, promote lamb to millennials. Come along to those meetings and hear about what we're doing. And we want to hear what you think as well, whether we've got our priorities right. And as I say, they can be robust conversations. We're happy for that because we all care about this industry a lot. So, you know, we're all up for that.
Absolutely. Okay. Well, now then, I'm gonna Brexit, right? I've purposely stayed away from it on the podcast before because it's been so divisive. But I do feel it's kind of settling down a bit now, and we can all argue, we can sort of talk about it all without screaming at each other. But we're all sort of getting used to the idea that it's happening.
And does Father Christmas exist? This is what you're going to ask. <isn't it?
laughs> how briefly? I mean, it's something you could talk about all night. But how are you feeling about the short and long term future for the beef and lamb industries?
Well, people who know me know I'm actually a pretty confident person, and I'm pretty confident for the future of beef and lamb in this country. And I look at the skill sets we've got, the quality of cattle and sheep we've got in this country, our ability to grow grass as best as anybody in the world. Of course, we could always do those things better, but in actual fact, we've got a tremendous foundation of resource and skill. We've also got a great market in the UK. You know, we have the highest beef price in the world. We have some of the best lamb prices in the world. I'm sure we can get our export markets into Europe, hopefully with a bit of common sense and some hard work maintained. And don't forget, you know, we've in the past, we can't market British lamb too strongly in France as British. We have to use other means because we're part of the European Union. But outside the European Union, we'll be able to push British a little bit more. Perhaps we'll be able to get a bit more premium into our lamb that might help with any tariff that's on it. So, and there are other markets opening up. You know, we've had more Chinese delegations across looking for lamb exports. We had a really good, we had about 30 sheep specialists from China come across for a week in the summer. They went away impressed and happy about what they saw. So we're opening up new markets. And I also confident in the long term because I meet so many young, amazing farmers who are doing great stuff. And they're totally awe-inspiring. So, yeah, no, farming has never been easy. There's never been a time when we've looked back and thought, well, you fell out of bed in the morning and made money. It's always been about hard work, graft, doing the right thing, coping with it when it goes wrong. It's never been easy. Let's not delude ourselves. But I believe it is a great industry, and there's so much passion out there to make it work because people are so proud about what, rightly proud about what they do. So I think, you know, working together, we'll have a strong future. Yeah, maybe a bit bumpy, but we'll get there.
Yeah.
And I think anybody who's been through BSE and foot and mouth and various other things, which some of the younger generation haven't, as you said, yeah, I think, well, if we can get through that, we can get through this.
That's a very good point. Yeah, I mean, like I said, I was at the Oxford Farm Conference last week, and I came away. I met so many sort of, as you say, really, really good young farms out people. I was on the Emerging Leader course, and the rest of the people on the course were so inspiring and positive to be around. I really did come away with a spring in my step for the future, for going forward, I think.
Well, it can be, let's face it, this industry is particularly good at grinding you down, especially after a long winter, and you've been cold and wet, and you've been paddling around in the mud all winter, and a couple of things have gone wrong. You do sort of scratch your head and say, why am I doing this? And then the May sun comes out, and you remember why. I think that's why it's so important that come along to sort of the farmer events, talk to other farmers. It does help lift the spirits and help you when you go back to the farm. It helps you that bit more gusto at trying to achieve some of the things you want to achieve.
Absolutely. Okay. Well, I'm just going to ask you, Chris, you're going to go off on a totally different track here. You're going to have to indulge me. My listeners have to indulge me as well, because as you know, I'm a massive history nerd. And you've got especially a World War One history nerd, and you've got a very illustrious ancestor, haven't you?
Well, yeah, my grandmother's first cousin was an amazing man, absolutely amazing. I mean, they're quite an amazing family. I mean, I think the Edwardians were pretty amazing, but yeah. He was especially amazing. He was a bishop's son, trained as a doctor, And during the First World War, he was awarded not just the Victoria Cross, but a Victoria Cross twice over. Sadly, posthumously, because he was killed, and then awarded a Victoria Cross afterwards. So, yeah, quite an amazing man, and who put other people very much felt his responsibilities and looked after people as much as he could, and was killed during that dreadful war. But that, you know, that impact on that whole family was also pretty amazing, you know, pretty dreadful. You know, he lost other siblings, my grandmother lost siblings, you know, typical story of the amount of losses. And I think that's it was kept, his spirit was kept alive by my grandmother recounting the tales of him. And she was a nurse out there as well at the same time, aged 18. Mm. We forget how young they were.
Absolutely, yeah. Because, I mean, you know, he was a doctor, wasn't he, out there saving
lives? He was, yeah. Yeah. And, you know, and was wounded himself and still carried on working on others to save their lives.
Mm. Mm. You must be very proud.
Well, I think the thing is that, to be honest with you, Will, there was lots of people out there who did hugely amazing, brave things, but simply were not recorded that they'd done them. Mm. And he did some amazing things and showed real fortitude and care for other people through difficult circumstances, but was recognised for it.
Okay. Right. I'm going to jump into my 5 in 10 questions now, if you're ready for these.
Go on in. Go on in.
What's your all-time favourite song?
I suppose that's a difficult one. I suppose Farming in Mind, Another Brick Wall, I think, by Pink Floyd, banging my head against it enough time.
But yeah, well, yeah, but we don't need no education. That's not what we're. Yeah. Okay, so you've accomplished an awful lot in your life. What are you most proud of?
I suppose I'm most proud of my family. You know, they're a great bunch of children who've grown up into great adults, and that's what I'm most proud of.
Okay, excellent answer. What do you do to switch off and relax when you're not running around the country?
Pick up a book on genetics.
Okay. All right. You're hosting a fancy dinner party for 3 guests. Anyone from history, alive or dead, who are you having?
I think Obama would have to be someone who'd be great to have at a dinner party.
Yeah.
I think he's been, you know, his intelligence, his calmness, his and a fascinating man, and his humour. Mm. I mean, you watch him talk, some of the speeches he's made, especially at the White House press dinner. Hugely funny, interesting man. So, yeah, he would definitely be on my list.
He'd be one. What about the other two?
I suppose that's a good question. There's so many interesting people you could sort of go and dig up, literally, couldn't there? Actually, I suppose I'd probably actually go and dig up my grandfather, who I never really met, who set up a dairy business and what have you. He'd be interesting to speak to and understand. And who else would I like to have there? I suppose William Pitt, to see if he was as young as people said he was.
That'd be an interesting dinner party. A good mix of politics and farming.
Yeah. It's good.
Okay, and lastly then, if you had to recommend a farmer to follow on social media to a non-farmer, who would it be and why?
Well, of course, it's yourself, Will.
Yeah, only if you want. Yeah, I'm sure.
Well, I suppose it's a difficult thing. I mean, there's some people on social media that are quite sort of confrontational and don't really sort of explain themselves very well, and almost believe that everybody should have a. But I think James Robinson up in the Northwest, JR from Strictly, he's a good one to follow because he's taken some fantastic photographs, yeah. But he explains very nicely and engages with people nicely. So I reckon James Robinson's a big one to follow.
Yeah. Well, I'd agree. He's a lovely fella. Yeah. He's a good friend of mine. Okay. Well, Adam, it's been an absolute pleasure to talk to you after chatting so many times on Twitter over the years and learn a bit more about you and what you do. So thanks very much for taking the time.
Cheers, Will. It's been good fun. Yeah. Thanks.
All right. Hopefully, okay. I'll bump into you sometime at a show or event somewhere.
Yeah. That'd be good. That'd be good.
And to everyone at home, thanks for listening. See you next time. I've been Will Evans. This has been Rock and Roll Farming. Thank you and good night.